Today is Tuesday, July 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak is found guilty in the first of several trials he faces on corruption charges.
Justice Muhammad Nazlan Muhammad Ghazali has sentenced Najib Razak to 12 years in jail.
Plus a look into the research for the malaria vaccine.
Why can't we have adequate protection against getting infected, even though we have protective antibodies?
And U.S. Attorney William Barr heads to Congress to testify. We'll have those stories and more next. Malaysia's former Prime Minister Najib Razak has been convicted of corruption related to the multi-million dollar looting of a state investment fund. Now, to get the details, I spoke with reporter Zan Azli in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, via WhatsApp about the verdict and what's next.
This first trial involves SRC International. Now, SRC International is a company, it's a subsidiary under 1MDB, 1MDB being the sovereign wealth fund by the Malaysian government, owned by the Malaysian government. And today, the judge has found Najib Razak, former Malaysian Prime Minister, guilty of all seven charges, which involves money laundering, abuse of power, and criminal breach of trust. And the amount that is linked to this particular trial, it comes to about 42 million Malaysian ringgit, which is approximately about US 10 million. So today he has been found guilty of all seven charges that comes under this trial.
Yeah, you mentioned that this is, you know, the first of many trials. So, I mean, what happens next? Because I believe he has five total trials in all. So how might this verdict for this subset of charges affect what's going to move forward?
Look, like it or not, from the very beginning, Najib Razak's scandal with 1MDB has been a public affair. It is very much a trial in the public's eyes, in the media as well. And if you remember, Malaysia had a general election in 2018, and Najib Razak, who was the Prime Minister then, he was leading the National Front, the Barisan National Party at that time, lost for the first time in the history of Malaysia, right? They've never lost the general election. And one of the main contributors to the loss for his party was actually the perception that the public had for the scandal, for the 1MDB corruption scandal that is directly linked to Najib Razak.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, this was one of the things that led his party to lose power. With him guilty, does that stand to hold true for upcoming elections as well?
Well, I mean, if you look at the recent past, the recent couple of months in Malaysia, there have been a change in government. After 2018, when Najib Razak's party lost the general election, the former opposition became the government. And in March this year, a few months ago, there was a jump in different members of parliament, and another party now is the government. And there has been talks that there may be snap elections that will be held in, you know, before the end of this year. And if there is going to be snap general elections, I think this will affect the elections, because right now Najib's party, UMNO, is actually now back in the government. And if they're going to have snap elections, I think it's going to affect the party very, very much, the verdict that has happened, that's come out today.
Zan, going back to former Prime Minister Najib Razak, what did the judge decide in terms of sentencing the former Prime Minister?
The verdict was done throughout the whole day, and the sentencing has come right at the end of the day before the court closed. Justice Muhammad Nazlan Muhammad Ghazali has sentenced Najib Razak to 12 years in jail, and fine him 210 million Malaysian ringgit for abuse of power. So he got, it's basically, he's been sentenced to 12 years in jail for abuse of power. He's been sentenced to 10 years in jail for each of his three criminal breach of trust charges, and also a 10-year term for money laundering. But all of these jail term time is will be served concurrently. So he's got a jail term of 12 years.
Zan Azli reports from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Nearly 16.5 million COVID-19 infections have been reported around the world, including over 654,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University statistics. In the United States, which leads the world in the number of confirmed cases, wide-scale testing began on Monday in the United States. on two potential COVID-19 vaccines to determine their safety and effectiveness. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, told reporters on Monday that the first results of the late-stage vaccine trial may be known as early as November. If the trial is successful, Moderna will produce 500 million doses within a year, with the hopes of making 1 billion doses annually in the beginning of 2021. The second experimental vaccine made by U.S.-based Pfizer in collaboration with Germany-based BioNTech SE will be given to 30,000 people across the United States, Brazil, Argentina, and Germany. Now, as the world continues to race to develop a vaccine for COVID-19, researchers from the Australian National University say they had discovered a vital clue as to why malaria vaccines keep failing, and that discovery could change how vaccines for other deadly diseases are made. Haley McNamara is a scholar and lead author of the research at the university's John Curtin School of Medical Research. She spoke with International Edition's Lori London about the findings.
Malaria has been around for a long time, and it's deadly and it's frightening because obviously it's so easy to get something like this with a little tiny mosquito in so many places that have so little access. And, you know, as we're looking here for the miracle vaccine for COVID, there are things that are out there that are deadly as well that we've been looking for years that we haven't been able to capture. And that would include malaria. But it sounds like your research has uncovered some significant findings. What exactly is this all about?
You're right. We've been looking to generate an effective malaria vaccine for decades, and the approach to this has been largely the same as for many other vaccines, where we identify a key target on the infectious agent, in our case, the malaria parasite, and then we work to make a vaccine that induces your body to make a lot of protective proteins called antibodies. Now, this approach is generally good for a lot of vaccines and against many diseases, but in malaria, we found that even though we can develop vaccines that do cause your body to make antibodies against the malaria parasite, they're unable to provide prolonged protection. And we really wanted to address why this was the case. Why can't we have adequate protection against getting infected, even though we have protective antibodies present, which are induced by our current vaccines?
So what was the outcome? What did you discover?
So what's quite interesting about malaria is that you need a really high amount of antibodies present to provide complete protection. So this may be because it's a complex pathogen. So at different stages of the malaria infection, it expresses different proteins. So it's really important if you want to catch and prevent the disease from progressing that you basically knock it out in one stage, which your immune system is primed to target. Because there's such a high requirement, or you need a lot of antibodies present, what we found is that this amount of antibody is actually unsustainable to be continually maintained within your body. Your body naturally maintains the antibody level at a much lower level. And what we found is this discrepancy between what we need for protection and what is actually normally maintained in the body is part of this negative feedback mechanism, which is basically your body's way of preventing it from needlessly making more antibody when it doesn't need to. And in most cases, in most diseases, this doesn't seem to be an issue. That's why we have vaccines for lots of other infections that don't seem to have this problem occurring. But because we need such high titers for malaria, this poses a problem. And what our research shows is that one way to overcome this may be designing vaccines that work on generating antibodies against multiple targets on the parasite rather than just one particular protein. And this is largely because when we talk about antibodies, they're highly specific. So if you have one antibody against protein A on the parasite, that means it will only bind to protein A, even if there's protein A, B, C, D on the parasite. So what we're saying is instead of having enormous amounts of antibodies against just protein A, which we can't sustain at such high levels, maybe have a reduced amount of antibodies against protein A, B, and D, and then together they can work synergistically to provide protection.
Fascinating. So where does it go from here as far as the work to actually find a vaccine to prevent malaria?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Obviously, this is showing that our current strategy of developing a vaccine is not going to work in this particular situation. It's starting to be realized as well, because people in the past have tried to really push getting the antibodies up to that high protective level by administering more booster vaccines, and that doesn't work because of this feedback mechanism. So I don't think we need to go right back to the drawing board. I think what we can do is we can build on some basic research, which has been looking at identifying other proteins on the parasite that may be targets. And if we can somehow incorporate them to our current vaccine strategies, that might be a way forward. Again, how to improve the current strategies. Potentially, we may need to start considering doing like a sequential vaccine. So rather than one vaccine, which is the same, and then maybe a booster, which is identical in structure, maybe we vaccinate sequentially where you have like your first vaccine is against one particular protein, your second is against a different protein on the parasite. So it's a sequential vaccination regime. That could potentially be another way to work around this. But again, this is just early days now, but we're really excited about how this has given us a key insight to why we keep having this problem with our vaccines for malaria.
Do you think this ultimately, this could be the game changer that scientists have been looking for with malaria and potentially other diseases that have eluded being able to find vaccines for, like HIV/AIDS?
I think it's definitely going to highlight consideration that we have to have with vaccine design, especially for these complex diseases that we have been having difficulty to generate effective vaccines for. Yes, absolutely. This particular phenomenon in immunology, it's actually been known, this whole antibody feedback, for ages, but people actually haven't looked at it in terms of vaccine responses and the immune response to vaccines. And I think what we're showing is that when we have these diseases where we know you need a lot of antibody present to provide protection, this now has to be considered. And when you start to design what these vaccines are looking like, maybe you have to start really thinking about if this could be a potential problem down the line.
Hayley McNamara is the lead of the research at the Australian National University's John Curtin School of Medical Research, located in Canberra, Australia. Business is not as robust as usual for cattle traders in Pakistan, as people who usually buy sacrificial animals ahead of the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha are going online rather than to dusty markets. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that story.
The sale yards of cows and oxen in Pakistan's livestock markets are usually bustling, with customers checking the coat and teeth of animals, discussing sizes and bartering over prices. Ahead of the Muslim festival of Eid, people usually buy sacrificial animals. But the government has imposed social distancing restrictions, opening the market for only a half day. And the worry of the coronavirus is keeping buyers at home. Tanzil Ahmed says he has already noticed changes in the lead-up to Eid al-Adha.
There are fewer customers in the market. Being Sunday, there should have been a good crowd here, but there are fewer people here. Because of the coronavirus, many people have opted for shared slaughter at mosques.
Many sellers are worried about making an income and say the restrictions are disrupting the markets. Trader Aladita travelled over 700 kilometres to the Karachi cattle market to sell his stock.
Last year the business was good. Last year the cattle market was open 24 hours. This year the time has been reduced to 12 hours, hurting our business. We are very worried.
Instead, customers are turning online. Some people are paying charities to slaughter cattle on their behalf and deliver their cut to them or donate it to the needy. Shaquille Dehelvi says his charity was almost fully booked in just 30 days. Pakistan has reported over 270,000 coronavirus cases, with daily cases of new infection just under 1,200 on Sunday, versus a peak last month nearing 7,000 around another Eid festival.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News, and VOA has expanded pandemic coverage on our website. And coming up later,
video released by Australian police Monday shows a disturbing sight. What appears to be a person with hands and feet bound and tied up in what police are calling a virtual kidnapping scam targeting Chinese students in Sydney.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
To get a unique perspective of the universe, NASA plans to launch a gigantic balloon to an altitude of about 40 kilometers above Antarctica in December 2023. Called ASTHROS, an acronym for the Astrophysics Stratospheric Telescope for High Spectral Resolution Observations at Submillimeter Wavelengths, the mission will send a state-of-the-art 2.5-meter far-infrared telescope along with scientific instruments to circle the South Pole for about 3 weeks. The balloon that will take the mission into the stratosphere will measure about 150 meters wide. ASTHROS will study some of the processes behind the formation of stars or even planets. According to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is managing the mission, Astros will also create detailed 3D maps of the density, speed, and motion of gas in star-forming regions of space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Attorney General William Barr defends the aggressive federal response to civil unrest around the country as he appears today before a House committee. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
According to a copy of William Barr's remarks to the House Judiciary Committee, he says violent rioters hijacked the protest movement over the death of George Floyd at the hands of police. A horrible event, he says, that prompted unnecessary national reckoning on police and community relations. But Barr condemns those who've responded with rioting and anarchy. He calls on all lawmakers to condemn violence against federal officers and federal buildings. Civil unrest escalated in Portland, Oregon, after federal agents arrived. And Washington, D.C. protests had been peaceful when federal officers used smoke bombs. Barr will also touch on his handling of the investigation into Trump campaign ties to Russia. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The mayors of Portland, Oregon, and five other major U.S. cities appealed on Monday to Congress to make it illegal for the federal government to deploy militarized agents to cities that don't want them. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
This comes as the feds say they will stay in Portland and possibly deploy more agents until the U.S. courthouse is safe. Last night, a few protesters set off firecrackers and tried to climb the fence in front of the building. The feds deployed tear gas. The mayors of Portland, Seattle, Chicago, Kansas City, Albuquerque, and Washington, all cities where President Trump has sent militarized agents under Operation Legend or threatened to, sent a letter to lawmakers saying the administration's egregious use of federal force on cities over the objections of local authorities should never happen. I'm Julie Walker.
China has announced that Hong Kong's government is scrapping a number of crime and law enforcement treaties with Canada, Britain, and Australia. The news came on the heels of New Zealand suspending its extradition treaty with Hong Kong. Foreign Affairs Minister Winston Peters said that New Zealand can no longer trust that Hong Kong's criminal justice system is sufficiently independent from China. The Chinese embassy in New Zealand called the decision a violation of international law and gross interference in China's internal affairs. Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard has fired a missile from a helicopter targeting a mock-up aircraft carrier in the strategic Strait of Hormuz. That's according to footage aired on state television Tuesday. Iranian commandos also fast roped down from a helicopter onto a replica in the footage from the exercise called Great Prophet 14. The drill appears aimed at threatening the United States amid tensions between Tehran and Washington. The replica resembles the Nimitz-class carriers that the U.S. Navy routinely sails into the Persian Gulf from the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow mouth of the waterway. The USS Nimitz, the namesake of the class, just entered Mideast waters late last week. A panel of experts led by former Irish President Mary Robinson has cleared the head of the African Development Bank, Akin Wumi Adesina, of corruption. Nicholas Pinault reports from Paris.
The panel of three experts led by Robinson alongside Gambia's Chief Justice Hassan Jallow and the World Bank's Integrity Vice President Leonard McCarthy cleared Adesina of all charges alleged by the whistleblowers. They claimed that under his watch, the bank had been tarred by poor governance, impunity, personal enrichment, and favoritism. The report said the panel concurs with the committee in its findings in respect of all the allegations against the president and finds that they were properly considered and dismissed by the committee. The panel did not investigate the charges themselves, as that was not within their mandate. The African banking institution and Adesina, who is the sole candidate for the bank's August presidential elections, has been battered by the allegations after the whistleblower's complaints were leaked to the media in April. The former Nigerian finance minister had always stated he was innocent of the charges. He was cleared by the organization's ethics committee, but international pressure has mounted with the United States calling in May for an independent investigation. The African Development Bank plays an important and largely behind-the-scenes role in African economies, financing projects in agriculture, health, energy, education, transport, and other development sectors. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
New South Wales police on Monday warned Chinese students to be aware of a new scam. Reuters' Gloria So reports.
Video released by Australian police Monday shows a disturbing sight. What appears to be a person with hands and feet bound and tied up in what police are calling a virtual kidnapping scam targeting Chinese students in Sydney. Police say the scam has already obtained millions in payments from unsuspecting victims. New South Wales official Darren Bennett explained the scam to reporters on Monday.
The offence types are very disparate in their range. They can form the intent to create a scam kidnapping where people communicate to their family overseas and pretend they've been kidnapped on instruction from a fraudster ringing them on the telephone.
Scammers call up the victims they plan to target, claiming to be from a Chinese authority like the police or tax department, according to the statement released by the NSW police. The caller then, quote, convinces the victim they have been implicated in a crime in China or that their identity has been stolen and that they must pay a fee to avoid legal action, arrest, or deportation. Bennett called the crimes, quote, egregious and very cruel.
A recent one that we've had was essentially threatening harm against people, family members in China, unless they contrive a photograph that makes them look like they've been kidnapped. Then they encourage the person to lock themselves away in a hotel room, turn their phones off, cease all contact. So the people in China have got a two-pronged threat. They've got this photo of their loved one and they can't get in touch with their loved one.
Bennett also warned that the phone calls are becoming very common and encouraged anyone receiving one not to fall for the scam.
That was Reuters' Gloria So. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
July marks the 70th anniversary of cooperation between the United States and the Kingdom of Cambodia. Since July 11, 1950, when diplomatic relations were established between the two countries, the United States and Cambodia have worked together to improve the lives of the Cambodian people. At times, relations between the countries were cool due to regional armed conflict. Nonetheless, the United States continued to support the Cambodian people, including through ASEAN's efforts in the 1980s to achieve a political settlement in Cambodia, which came to fruition in 1991 with the signing of a comprehensive settlement at the Paris Conference. When the democratically elected royal government of Cambodia was formed on September 24, 1993, the United States and the Kingdom of Cambodia immediately reestablished full diplomatic relations. The United States continues to support democratic institutions and promote respect for human rights in Cambodia. The two countries work together to increase trade and to contribute to regional and global security. The United States supports Cambodia's efforts to reduce the prevalence of HIV/AIDS and other infectious diseases, improve nutrition for mothers and children, eliminate human trafficking and corruption, address environmental degradation, better manage natural resources, and foster economic development. Today, amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. government has so far provided $11 million to help Cambodia's medical and public health response to the disease and to mitigate the secondary impacts resulting from the pandemic. The United States has invested almost $3 billion over the past three decades to assist Cambodia recovering from conflict, said U.S. Ambassador to Cambodia Patrick Murphy in an interview obtained by the Voice of America's Cambodian service. I think we have seen results of this partnership.
Cambodia has been very prosperous. Economic development has increased and relatively stable and peaceful. And there has been some justice for past atrocities, which is very important for the rule of law and contending with history as the country moves ahead into the future. We also see, I think, a lot of return on our contributions to specific areas like education, public health, the environment, law enforcement, demining, and other humanitarian assistance areas.
The U.S. government, he said recently, is committed to continuing its support to the Cambodian people towards sustainable, inclusive, and equitable socioeconomic development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.